All right, we move to something called futurism. Time has gone on over 100 years from the time when the Lord clearly wanted to take his people home. And this was during the lifetime of those who had lived through the 1840 experience. They knew the landmarks of our faith. They knew our foundations. And now, today, they're all gone. There's not one left, obviously, including the prophetic voice. So we're looking for reasons again for this embarrassing and humiliating delay in the second coming of Jesus Christ. Since our basis for the movement has been in Daniel and Revelation, we've gone back to these books to try to find some explanation for the delay, and some believe that we have been using a wrong method of interpreting the books of Daniel and Revelation, that we need a better method that will enable us to see Jesus Christ come. One writer says, he quotes Christ's Object Lessons 127, "In every age there is a new development of truth." So he says there's new light out of Daniel and Revelation for us in the closing scenes. It has become popular to advocate a dual application of the books of Daniel and Revelation, since Matthew 24 gives a dual application of the destruction of Jerusalem and the end of the world. So Christ used dual fulfillment. Suggestion is made, here's how it works, that up until 1844, we used the day equals year principle. Day equals year in prophecy. After 1844, it changes to day equals day in prophecy. So we take all of the prophecies that had a day-year fulfillment, and now we make them all day equals day fulfillment after 1844. And so it is said, since the historical approach has failed to produce the latter rain, we need a new method of interpreting Scripture. Once again, there is truth at the bottom of every error and these attempts to reinterpret prophecy. History will be repeated. There's the truth. History will be repeated. What took hundreds of years in the Middle Ages to develop persecution, church-state union, the rise of a voice for God, that will be compressed into a very short time at the end of Earth's existence. The history of the Middle Ages will be repeated. Church-state union, persecution, and the rise of a people who will stand for God. So history, yes, will be repeated. That does not necessarily mean that prophecies have dual applications. And there's where I think the problem comes. Now, there are some chapters in the books of Daniel and Revelation that haven't been given any inspired help in the spirit of prophecy. She's entirely silent about them. We have done our best to understand the seals and the trumpets. We've come up with this theory or that theory about the seals and the trumpets in the book of Revelation without much inspired help. And I'm not concerned about that issue at all. I think that there is an area, if inspiration is silent, where we have some latitude, we can develop ideas as best we can from the Word of God. That's not my concern. My concern is with those prophecies of the books of Daniel and Revelation, which have had clear, definite fulfillments in past history and are now being given new, more important fulfillments yet in the future. That's my concern. So let me restate that. My concern is with those prophecies that have had clear, definite fulfillment in the past and are now, we are being told, that was just a partial fulfillment, not the real fulfillment. The real fulfillment of those exact prophecies is in the future, reapplying them to day-for-day time in the future. Let's just look. Now, did I put my Bible back down there? I bet I did, somewhere under your coat. Let's go to the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 2. And we're just going to take a quick thumbnail look at the issues here in place. Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Look at verse 36, what he said to the king. "This is the dream." He just repeated the dream. "And we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king." So both the dream and the interpretation are given to Daniel. Turn over to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7, verse 15. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things. So Daniel didn't get just the vision, he got the interpretation of the vision. That's the point. Look down in verse 28. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me. So in other words, Daniel did not understand everything, and he needed special help right here from God. All right, over to chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 15. It came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me a man as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of Uli, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. Vision and understanding, both critical. Chapter 9, verse 23. At the beginning of thy supplications, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Therefore understand the matter and consider the vision. Key point, God gave both the vision and the interpretation to Daniel so there'd be no misunderstanding. In other words, it wasn't just a dream. You, Daniel, figure out what it means. Both vision and interpretation. Nowhere in the books of Daniel and Revelation is there a hint that this was only a preliminary fulfillment, this interpretation that was given by the angel. This was just a little fulfillment, and the real fulfillment you have to figure out for yourself. Nothing in the many visions given to Ellen White did she suggest we need a dual fulfillment of the prophecies of Daniel and Revelation. She doesn't suggest that. In fact, there is nothing about Iraq, Iran, the United States, Russia, as the real fulfillment of these four beasts. The four beasts are kingdoms of the past in historical time. Where now we're being told, no, it really refers to the kingdoms of our time. That's what the real meaning of these are. The important principle is that if there is to be dual fulfillment, and there are a few cases in the Bible, like Matthew 24, later inspired counsel needs to corroborate that second fulfillment. That's a key point. If there is to be a second fulfillment of a prophecy, then we need some inspired help to say, the first one was the first step, and now this is the second step. And we simply don't have that in the writings of Ellen White. So interpretations as well as dreams were given to Daniel. It's important to notice that the loud cry could have begun shortly after 1888 if the message of Christ's righteousness had been accepted. Ellen White, God's prophet for that time, says nothing about needing or accepting a new method of interpreting the books of Daniel and Revelation. In fact, Uriah Smith had a book out at that time called Daniel and Revelation, and there are many endorsements of that book by Ellen White, not just a few, as containing light and truth. Now, that does not mean that everything he said was perfect. He was not inspired, but she was saying his method is sound. You can trust his method. And the fact that history will be repeated again does not mean that prophecy will be repeated. The time prophecies that are most often applied to the future are the 1260, the 1290, and the 1335. Those are the specific prophecies. Now let's take a look at Revelation chapter 13. And I'll tell you how this works from the perspective of those who want to reapply the prophecies. Revelation chapter 13. In verse 3, I saw one of his heads as it was wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. Okay? Now, we have understood that to mean that the deadly wound inflicted in 1798 by the Pope being taken captive was healed during a process which culminated around 1929 in giving the Vatican State back full authority. Now, Having said that, that is now in the 1900s period. Then go to verse 5. And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. That's 1260 days. So notice how this works. If this is to be fulfilled in chronological sequence, that's the claim of those who reinterpret the prophecies. The verse 3 describes up until around 1929. Verse 5 says there will be 1260 days after 1929. That's what they're saying. 42 months equals 1260 days. 42 months is the same prophecy as 3.5 years as 1260 days. All right. So here we have 1929 fulfilled, the world wonders, power given back, and now after that time, you've got 1260 days yet to be fulfilled in the future. That's the claim of those who reapply the prophecies of Daniel and Revelation. This is based on the false assumption that the books of Daniel and Revelation are always in chronological order. That verse 5 is in chronological order after verse 3. In fact, just the opposite is true. In many cases, Revelation goes back and repeats previous history and then brings it up and then goes back again and repeats and brings it up. Daniel does the same thing. He goes back, he repeats, brings it up, and then goes on in sequence. So the false assumption is that the books of Daniel and Revelation are chronologically in order, so that verse 5 has to be after verse 3 in chronological time. In fact, here is what I'm going to share with you is how this can't work. In verse 11, "And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon." Who does that refer to? That's us, folks. That's us. The two horns like a lamb, speaking mildly, all of a sudden speaking as a dragon. All right? So there you have something interesting that if this is in chronological order, in verse 3 you have the healing of the wound, 1920s. In verse 5 you have 1260 more days. And in verse 11, another beast comes out of the earth after the 1260 days. Then it can't be the United States. And our whole method of prophecy interpretation is wrong. This is another beast that we don't even know about somewhere down the line in the future. It's going to happen and we don't know when and where. So if it's in chronological order, the whole thing of verses 11 to 15 describing the United States of America has been wrong. And we know from help in the spirit of prophecy that is not wrong. That is the United States of America. So this chapter cannot be in chronological order. That's the fatal mistake of those who want to reapply the prophecies of Daniel and Revelation. Ellen White said it this way. This is Manuscript Releases, Volume 10, pages 269 and 270. "Our position has been one of waiting and watching, with no time proclamation to intervene between the close of the prophetic periods in 1844 and the time of our Lord's coming." What is she saying? No more time proclamation after 1844. No more time counting after that time period ends. That's what Ellen White is saying. Here's what one Adventist futurist says. "The historical approach has served us well in the past, but like the horse and buggy, no longer fits our needs. It is like the horse and buggy, no longer relevant." In other words, the way we've interpreted prophecy just doesn't work anymore. And thus the book Daniel and Revelation, by Uriah Smith, which Ellen White told the young men to do all they could to sell this book, which she said should be studied carefully by students in our schools, is no longer relevant, because that is the historical position, if the futurist position is correct. So Ellen White used the historical method consistently. Now let's look at those 1260, 1290, and 1335 of Daniel 12. That's where you'll find them, in Daniel 12. Here's a statement. I'm going to share this statement with you. It is hard to understand. I'm going to challenge your thinking as you follow the logic here. Ellen White wrote this. We told him, that's an individual, of some of his errors in the past, that the 1,335 days were ended, and numerous errors of his. You can find that if you want to in Manuscript Releases, Volume 5, page 203. Now, you try to figure out that statement. I'm going to say something here that some may not be fully understood because I haven't gone into this. Sometimes prophets don't always make themselves crystal clear. Have you noticed that? Even in the Bible, Paul, etc. Sometimes they're misunderstood. I think Ellen White could have rewritten this sentence to make it more understandable. So let me tell you how you can interpret this in two different ways. We told him, this individual, of some of his errors in the past. We told him that the 1,335 days were ended, and we told him other numerous errors of his. That's one way you can interpret it. Here's the other way. We told him of some of his errors in the past, one of them being that the 1,335 days were ended, and other errors of his. So was it an error that the 1,335 days ended in 1844? Or was it that that was a true statement and he had some errors? This is a really difficult statement to figure out. There's no way we can figure it out by reading it. We told him of some of his errors in the past, that the 1,335 days were ended, and numerous errors of his. Is it truth or error that the 1,335 days ended in 1844? Well, the key to unlock this little problem statement is the word we. We told him. Who do you think she might be talking about? We told him. How about her husband? It was her husband. James and Ellen White held meetings here and there around the country. We told him. So what do you think James believed on this subject? We know what James White believed. Here is what he said. Evidences are conclusive that the 1,335 days ended with the 2,300 with the midnight cry of 1844. That's what James White believed. The 1,335 is not in the future somewhere. It ended in 1844. That's definitely what James White believed. And if we told him, there's no way that James would say that it's still in the future sometime. The 1,335, you start counting it and it'll end up when Jesus comes. There's no way James would have said that. So if the word we has any meaning, she is saying, here's how she had to mean it. We told him of some of his errors in the past. We told him that the 1,335 days were ended, and we told him about other errors that he held. That's the only possible meaning that James and Ellen could give to that statement together, that it's an error to believe that the 1,335 is still in the future sometime. So that is the historical position. The 1260 ends with 1844. The 1290 ends with 1844. The 1335 ends with 1844. No more time proclamations after 1844. That's the historical position. All right? Now, Daniel 11 and 12. In Daniel 12, there are several key words. Daily, taken away, abomination, desolate, set up. Key words in Daniel 12. In Daniel 11:31 are the same key words. Take away, daily, place, which means set up, abomination, desolate. And Daniel 11 describes the period between 538 and 1798 of the papal rule. That is a clear statement that we understand. So if Daniel 11 uses the words of Daniel 12, maybe both refer to the same period of time, the papal rule of the Middle Ages. So Daniel 11 and 12 both describe the Middle Ages rule of the papacy. Ellen White, the people will not have another message upon definite time. After this period of time, reaching from 1842 to 1844, there can be no definite tracing of the prophetic time. The longest reckoning reaches to the autumn of 1844. That is a clear statement that she's making. Bible Commentary, Volume 7, 971. No more tracing of definite time. Yet all the futurists have time in the future. They trace time in the future. I'm going to share with you one little thing that is maybe of some interest here. This is a letter written to an individual by the name of John Bell. And she's writing to him in 1896, and here is what she says to him. "I've not been able to sleep since 1:30. I was bearing to Brother John Bell a message which the Lord had given me for him. The peculiar views he holds are a mixture of truth and error." And then she says, "There have been one and another who, in studying their Bibles, thought they discovered great light and new theories, but these have not been correct." Now, what is the mixture of truth and error that John Bell was teaching in 1896? "Some will take the truth applicable to their time and place it in the future. Events in the train of prophecy that had their fulfillment away in the past are made future." What John Bell was doing, he was saying that the three angels' messages really are all in the future, when Ellen White says it came about in the 1844 movement. And he's saying, no, it's all in the future. It was true there, but it's more true in the future. That's what he was teaching. And then she said, "From the light that the Lord has been pleased to give me, you are in danger of doing the same work, presenting before others truths which have had their place and done their specific work for the time in the history of the faith of the people of God. You recognize these facts in Bible history as true, but apply them to the future. They still have their force in their proper place in the chain of events that have made us as a people what we are today, and as such, they are to be presented to those who are in the darkness of error." So what is she saying? The truths that are fulfilled in the prophecies leading up to 1844 are true in their place, and as such, they are to be presented to our people. "You and other of our brethren must accept the truth that God has given to his students of prophecy from their voices and pens," that's Uriah Smith and others. "The truth in bright, warm rays has gone to all parts of the world, and that which was to them testing truth is testing truth to all to whom this message is proclaimed. Those who have set themselves to study out new theories have a mixture of truth and error combined. According to the light God has given me, you are on the wrong track. That which appears to you to be a chain of truth is in some lines misplacing the prophecies and counterworking that which God has revealed as truth." So what John Bell was doing is he was saying that these prophecies in the past had a fulfillment, but the real fulfillment is in the future. Dual application of prophecies, re-fulfillment of the prophecies. True here, more true here. And she is saying, and that statement is very important, "You are on the wrong track. The Lord will not lead minds now to set aside the truth that the Holy Spirit has moved upon his servants in the past to proclaim." So that's the John Bell paper. No reapplication of the prophecies and had fulfillment in the past to the future. And by the way, just as a sidelight, as a testimony that was in, I'm not sure exact year now, but shortly after that by A.G. Daniels, John Bell has taken a splendid position on the testimony concerning his book. He has set aside his erroneous views altogether and stands in the best position I have known him at all. So there was a rare example of an individual being reproved by a prophet and accepting the reproof. That doesn't happen too much. It had a good ending. The last point I'm going to mention on this. This is actually a form of time setting for the second coming of Christ. How does that work? By the way, there's a lot of speculation. Once you get into this futurism thing, everyone has their own idea. Some say it's this way, some say it's that way. There's hardly two agreed. Everyone has their own perspective on it. And we begin to focus, and here's the key point, on dates and events and how many popes have been ruling and when the last pope is going to rule, rather than heart-searching so we can receive the latter rain. We focus on events and people rather than heart preparation. I see that as the great danger of futurism in the Adventist Church. Counting the popes doesn't get us anywhere, folks. It just doesn't. Here's how the time setting works. Most of the people who say the clocks restart, 1260, 1290, 1335, say that the clocks start when the Sunday law is passed. Okay? So when the Sunday law is passed, whenever that comes to pass, you start the clock ticking. And you start counting, in some cases 1260 to a certain event, 1290 to another event, 1335 to another event. And the last fulfillment of the last of the prophecies is that great day when God announces the time of his second coming and delivers his people from the death decree. I don't think I have to go through all that scenario. The death decree is passed. There's a certain time for the execution of all God's faithful people who won't bow to the authority of the state. And at that moment, when they are ready to destroy God's people, God splits the heavens apart. He doesn't come. This is not the second coming. This is the announcement by God. These are my people, and I will be coming for them. And you can read all about that in Great Controversy in the ending chapters. And so at this moment, this is when the clocks end. They begin at the passing of the Sunday law. They end at the voice of God speaking the day and hour of Jesus' coming. That is consistent in all of the futurism aspects. Well, if that's the case, the announcement of the day and hour of Jesus' coming is just a few days, maybe 3 or 4 days, we don't know, before the second coming of Christ. So we'll know within just a few 24-hour periods when Jesus is going to come back. So if I'm sitting in a jail cell somewhere and I'm following the futurist plan of interpreting prophecy, when that Sunday law is passed, I start marking up on the walls of my jail cell, day one, day two, and I know that there can't be more than 1,335 days until the second coming of Jesus Christ. In other words, I have set a time for the coming of Jesus Christ once the Sunday law has been passed. Within, as I say, just a few days, a few 24-hour periods. It is a subtle, misunderstood, but real form of time setting in which we can set the date. I don't read anything like that as I read the scenario. We're going to be wondering if it's all going to happen. We're going to have our faith tested to the limit. We're not going to be counting dates on our cell walls as to how many days are left before Jesus appears in the clouds of heaven. That, to me, is not what I read anywhere in this scenario of the second coming of Jesus Christ. So that is why I say it is a very subtle form of time setting. All right, that's futurism. I have not done any real justice to that, but I do want to say that I don't think the dual application of putting time periods in the future is the way that we should be going in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I don't think that's new light. Now I'm going to deal with the most prevalent issue facing conservative Adventists today. This one is even more dominant than the anti-Trinity movement that I spoke of in the last period, the feast days. Over the last decade, I have been receiving, and I mean a large number of papers and open letters and booklets on one theme, the necessity of observing the national festivals called feasts of the Jews if we are going to be the final generation to see Jesus Christ come, along with our Sabbath, Seventh-day Sabbath, of course. This has been gathering momentum within the past 15 years, and many of my close friends now believe strongly in the feast day movement. And there are national conventions held, camp meetings, totally dedicated to this one issue. And so this is the biggest one right now, focusing on how we can prepare for the second coming of Christ. Now, a lot, and I'm telling you, a lot has been written and spoken about this issue, and I can't cover all the material. There's a lot of technical material involved here based on language usage and historical practices, but I'll try to address the major issues enough to make good decisions. As in previous discussions, truth is at the basis for the claim of the feast days. Didn't God give a marvelous, and I mean a marvelous, plan for Israel to teach the great controversy and the plan of salvation? Throughout the year, every time that they went through the sequence of Passover and Pentecost and the trumpets and the Day of Atonement and the Feast of Tabernacles, they learned something new about the great controversy between Christ and Satan and how God would deal with sin and sinners. It's all It's all there in the sanctuary system and in the feast days, the festivals. And every year they would repeat those lessons so the children growing up would learn something about God's plan and how it would all work out. Every new generation would understand what God is doing in the great controversy. It was an outstanding teaching tool. There could have been no better. Well, because of apostasy in the Christian church, and because of the fact that the Christian church became very opposed to anything called Jewish, they hated anything called Jewish, these observances, these feasts, were totally forgotten. And guess what we replaced them with? Christmas and Easter and Halloween. Those are the great Christian festivals. Can you see why there's a problem? Listen, if Christians would have continued to teach and emphasize the feasts that the Jews understood and what they were saying about God and His character and His judgment, we would understand a whole bunch of things that Adventists are very fuzzy about right now, including the dual nature of the atonement, that there is an atonement done at the cross and there is atonement in the heavenly sanctuary going on right now in the heavenly sanctuary. We would understand the reasons for a judgment in the heavenly courts, an investigative judgment. We would understand Christ's new work since 1844 if we just examined the sanctuary and the feast days. It would all be crystal clear. If we would have studied the feasts more carefully, we would not be in confusion today about righteousness by faith, about the judgment, about the purpose of the last generation. The feasts were and are a tremendous teaching tool for God's people, and they can be very useful today. That's the truth. So what's the error? Make no mistake now. Those promoting the feasts are saying much more than this. Let me read to you what they say. Those who go through the end and are translated will be teaching the statutes and judgments. The law is the Ten Commandments and the statutes. It is also the fundamental teaching which the 144,000 must embrace if they are to give the loud cry. The antediluvians were destroyed for not keeping the statutes, and this will be the ultimate factor which brings the end destruction upon mankind. The 144,000 will teach the statutes in the last days. The statute message is the very heart of the message carried in the loud cry to the world. And guess what? The feasts are part of the statutes. They are. So if we're going to be teaching the statutes, if they're part of the moral law, if they are the test for the 144,000, we have to be keeping the feasts because they're part of the statutes. That's what they're saying. We're being told now that only feast keepers will be translated. Only those who are keeping all the statutes will be translated. That is necessary to be part of the 144,000. If you are not keeping the feast, you cannot be part of the 144,000. That the feast message is the heart of the final loud cry message to the world. So then it's much more than a teaching tool. It is the final test by which the 144,000 will receive the seal of God. That's what is being said. For instance, regarding the hailstones that come down on the seventh plague, God now stones with hail those who refuse to keep His holy days. So if you're not keeping the feasts, you will be stoned with the hailstones of the seventh plague. That's what they are saying. So again, what I'm saying is the truth. The truth is that the feasts are a tremendous teaching tool and we need to be studying them today. The error is they are the final test. If you keep them, you will be translated, you will receive the seal of God. If you don't keep them, you'll be destroyed in the plagues. That's the error. And I want to share with you why I believe this is such a serious problem. So we'll start. The claim is made that the feasts were part of the heavenly sanctuary before Lucifer fell, and part of the creation of the earth before sin. They were keeping the feasts in heaven. They were keeping the feasts when Adam was in the Garden of Eden. And it is based on one Hebrew word. The word is moed, M-O-E-D, moed. Now this word can have a number of meanings. It can mean appointment, festival, assembly, congregation, appointed time. And it is completely improper to assume that every time the word moed is used, it refers to the feast, since the meaning varies according to the context and the subject discussed. So I want to give you a couple examples so you'll know what I'm talking about. Go to a book that we hardly ever look up in the Old Testament. It is the book of Lamentations, right after Jeremiah. Lamentations. First chapter. Verse 15. Lamentations, chapter 1, verse 15. The Lord hath trodden underfoot all my mighty men in the midst of me. He hath called an assembly against me to crush my young men. The Lord hath trodden the virgin, the daughter of Judah, as in a winepress. The word assembly is moed. The word assembly is moed. Does that have anything to do with a feast day there? No. This is a group of people who are going to destroy Judah. So it has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with a feast. It's the word that they are using that they say always means a feast day. Take another example. Numbers, the book of Numbers, chapter 14. Numbers, chapter 14, verse 10. This is the story of Caleb and Joshua. You know what it was all about there, that they came back with their testimony to go in and the people didn't like it. Numbers 14, verse 10, but all the congregation bade stone them with stones, and the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle. The word congregation is moed. Does that sound like a feast that they were having for the Lord? No. This was a rebellious group of the Israelites who were ready to destroy the true representatives of God. The congregation, that's moed. So I think you can get the picture. I'll give you a couple other texts. We won't take time to look them up. Jeremiah 8, 7. Hosea 2:9, using the word in different ways. So in other words, to say that since the word moed appears about the angels in heaven or about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, that means they were keeping the feast days. No, it doesn't mean that at all. It means that there was a group of people, a congregation in heaven. And so it has nothing to say about the feasts. The claim that since the plan of salvation was laid at the foundation of the world and the feasts are an unfolding of the plan of salvation, therefore the feasts were established at creation, is an interesting logical deduction with no inspired evidence to back it up. Not one, that the feasts existed before Sinai. The word moed cannot be used to prove their existence. Listen, when did the Passover begin? Coming out of Egypt. That's when it began. There was no evidence they kept the Passover before then. When did the Day of Atonement begin? After they had come out and the sanctuary system was established, they kept the Day of Atonement. When would the Feast of Tabernacles be kept? After they came out of slavery. So in all of these cases, every one of the feasts began only with Israel being delivered from slavery. There is not one hint that there was a feast that was kept before that time. All connected with the chosen people. So here's a principle, folks. This doesn't apply to just this. Everything in Bible study. When you read a text, you draw out everything you can out of the text, but you make no inferences on what the text might mean. That's a very important principle. You get out everything you can out of that text, but no inferences about possible speculative ideas. Maybe this could mean that. Moed might mean that they were keeping the feasts in heaven. No, it doesn't say that. That's speculation, and it's very dangerous. Okay. There are many statements by Ellen White to prove feast keeping. Let me read you a couple. In these last days, there is a call from heaven inviting you to keep the statutes and ordinances of the Lord. Well, that's interesting. In these last days, keeping the statutes. That's Signs of the Times, Volume 2, 184. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes. Volume 5, Review and Herald, 83. But the most famous statement is in Review and Herald, May 6, 1875. This is the one used by those who keep the feasts as their proof statement from Ellen White as to why the feasts have to be kept. So let's go through a couple statements. Here's what she says. In consequences of continual transgression, the moral law was repeated in awful grandeur from Sinai. Christ gave to Moses religious precepts which were to govern the everyday life. Okay, now, stop right there. Was the moral law first given at Mount Sinai, according to what we just read? It says repeated. So they knew about it before. You can read about it in the various examples of Abraham and the patriarchs. They knew about the moral law. So it was repeated at Sinai. But Christ gave to Moses new precepts. He didn't repeat them. They were new. He gave them to Moses. So the Ten Commandments were repeated. They had already been in existence. The various laws given to Moses were given first time. And then she says, these statutes were explicitly given to guard the Ten Commandments. And here's the statement they use. They were not shadowy types to pass away with the death of Christ. They were to be binding upon men in every age as long as time shall last. These commands were enforced by the power of the moral law, and they clearly and definitely explained that law. So for the feast keepers, this statement says that the statutes given to guard the Ten Commandments did not end when Christ died. They are binding upon men in every age as long as time shall last. Therefore, the feasts have to be kept until Jesus comes. That's their conclusion. All right? That's how they understand the feasts and the statutes. Every time the word statute is written, they understand feasts. And that's legitimate because the feasts were part of the statutes. So keep that in mind. That is their primary proof text. But notice what she said. These statutes were explicitly given to guard the Ten Commandments. So is there something different between the Ten Commandments and what guards the Ten Commandments? What protects the Ten Commandments? So in other words, the statutes are not the Ten Commandments, but they're applications of the Ten Commandments to specific situations so that you don't run afoul of the Ten Commandments. They kind of put a wall around the Ten Commandments to protect it from being destroyed. And so that is a different issue. So let me read a little more on this letter, this article. The statutes and judgments specifying the duty of man to his fellow men were full of important instruction, defining and simplifying the principles of the moral law. Notice that, simplifying the principles of the moral law for the purpose of increasing religious knowledge and preserving God's chosen people distinct and separate from idolatrous nations. The statutes concerning marriage, inheritance, and strict justice in dealing with one another were peculiar and contrary to the customs and manners of other nations and were designed of God to keep his people separate from other nations. The necessity of this to preserve the people of God from becoming like the nations who had not the love and fear of God is the same in this corrupt age when the transgression of God's law prevails and idolatry to exist to a fearful extent. If ancient Israel needed such security, we need it more to keep us from being utterly confounded with the transgressors of God's law. The hearts of men are so prone to depart from God that there is a necessity for restraint and discipline. So once again, it is said by those who believe in the feast that since the statutes and judgments were important then, they are just as important now. The feasts are to protect us from becoming contaminated with the world, just as they protected Israel from being contaminated with the world. So that's how they understand this statement from Ellen White, Review and Herald, May 6, 1875. So I'm going to suggest some things right now. First of all, in this entire article, Ellen White starts out with the moral law. Then she describes the ceremonial law. And the ceremonial law is those things which point to the death of Christ. Sacrifices. Various things which say that there is going to be a Redeemer who will come. And then she refers to a third category, which she calls statutes and judgments. She says they are not the Ten Commandments. They are given to guard the Ten Commandments. So they can't be part of the Ten Commandments if they guard the Ten Commandments. It's a third category. They are not part of the ceremonial law because she said they were not shadowy types to pass away with the death of Christ. So they're neither moral nor are they ceremonial. They are statutes, third category of law. She says they were to govern the everyday life, to protect life, the duty of man to God and his fellow men. They apply to marriage. They apply to inheritance. They apply to strict justice in business affairs and to keep the people from following the customs of other nations. All right, just one example, the laws of inheritance. The laws of inheritance said that you could not sell your property finally. You could only sell it, which was really renting it, for 49 years. And in the 50th year, it would revert back to the original owner in the year of Jubilee. That was the law of inheritance. In other words, you as a family could never lose your property. If you got into hard times, if things went bad for you, you could sell your property. But you would get it back again at the end of the 49 years. That was to protect a poor class and a wealthy class from developing in Israel. You would always get your property back. So property could never be sold. It could only be rented for a period of whatever was left of that 50-year Jubilee cycle. That was the law of inheritance. And there were precise rules on this. Did our early pioneers, or did Ellen White, ever follow that practice? Not one. Not one. In our society, the ways of dealing with property have completely changed. And this issue of inheritance is not one of those statutes and judgments which have to be kept forever, even though the principles are there that are necessary. And one other thing. The statutes that Ellen White is referring to here in this article come from Exodus 21 to 23, and there is not one word about the feasts in that section, Exodus 21 to 23. So this is the clearest statement of Ellen White to prove feast keeping, and it makes no reference to feasts. Not one reference in this entire article about the feasts that were to be kept. Nowhere does Ellen White make a direct connection between the statutes and the feasts. She just doesn't do that. That's an interpretive deduction. And I want to do something which you might find a little interesting. I'm going to ask you to take your Bible right now and look at some statutes with me. Some statutes which are supposed to be kept as long as time shall last. Turn with me to Leviticus chapter 7. Leviticus chapter 7, verse 34. For the wave sheaf and the heave shoulder, these are parts of the offerings that they brought to the sanctuary, have I taken of the children of Israel from off the sacrifices of their peace offerings, and have given them unto Aaron the priest and unto his sons by a statute forever from among the children of Israel. Now, if the statutes don't come to a natural end when Israel ceased to be a nation, as we're being told, the statutes continue on until the end of time, then if ministers are priests today, you should be bringing your wave sheafs and your heave shoulders instead of your tithes and offerings to the priests and the ministers, because that's a statute forever. So there's a statute which we don't follow anymore. It's the same category as the feast days, but in this case, we don't follow that statute. Let's try another one. Exodus chapter 30. Exodus chapter 30, beginning with verse 19. For Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands and their feet thereat, this is the laver. When they go into the tabernacle of the congregation, they shall wash with water, that they die not. Or when they come near to the altar to minister to burnt offering made by fire unto the Lord, so they shall wash their hands and their feet, that they die not, and it shall be a statute forever to them, even to him and to his seed throughout their generations. So every minister, priest today, every minister, before we enter the church, must have a laver in which we wash our hands and our feet, so we die not as we approach the tabernacle of God, if this statute is going to be followed forever. So once again, we don't follow that statute because we don't have lavers and we don't have this system of understanding what God is doing. Let's try another one. back to Leviticus, Leviticus chapter 19. And I think these are even easier to understand. Leviticus chapter 19. These are all statutes. And we're being told we must keep all of the statutes, or else we won't receive the seal of God. Leviticus 19, verse 27. Ye shall not round the corners of your heads, neither shalt thou mar the corners of thy beard. Let's read that, what it really says. You don't dare trim your beard. What about the ones of us who shave every morning? And then, if you want to know exactly what that is, in verse 37, therefore shall ye observe all my statutes and all my judgments and do them. This is a statute. The Israelite men cannot mar, meaning change, the way their beard forms. They must wear a full beard. Well, I don't see anyone here with a full beard. I see a beard or two trimmed. But that is not what this text is talking about. You have marred the corners of your beard, and you are not keeping the statute. One more thing that is not being observed today. One last one. Numbers chapter 15. Numbers 15. Numbers 15, 38. Speak unto the children of Israel, and bid them that they make them fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of the borders a riband of blue. And it shall be for you as for a fringe, that ye may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord. These are part of the statutes. And do them, that ye seek not after your own heart and after your own eyes, which ye used to go whoring. So, first of all, you must wear a garment with fringes on it, and then you put a ribbon of blue on the fringe of that garment, or you are not a statute keeper. There you are. There is another statute. And remember, we're being told that we must observe all of the statutes that were given to Israel until Jesus comes. And by the way, there's a statute in Exodus 21 that regulates slavery. 6 years you could be a slave, but the seventh year you would go free. And that means that that statute as well would apply to us today, that I or you or someone else could have a slave for 6 years if I let him go on the seventh year. It regulates slavery. So the statutes, remember this now, this is the key. The statutes were a subset of the moral law. They're not the moral law. They were to protect and guard the moral law from being misunderstood and abused during the time of Israel. They began at Sinai. The moral law began at the beginning of creation. They began at Sinai, and they end when there is no longer a theocracy under which God's rules are the only rule of living. When the theocracy ends, these statutes come to an end. That's not necessarily the death of Christ. That is when Judah ceases to be the people that God will use for his work on this earth. And so the statutes are in a different category. Now, it's suggested, even by those who keep the feast, that we're not to follow the specific command like the ribbon of blue, but we're to look for the principle behind the command. And that's right. That is the only possible conclusion. The principles of the statutes are to be binding as long as time shall last. What's the principle of a ribbon of blue? Distinctiveness and modesty and carefulness in dress. Is that a principle that we need to have as long as time shall last? What about the corners of the beard? You know what that was about? The pagan priests had special ways to trim their beard and their hair. And God says, don't be like the pagan priests. Make yourself distinctive from them, from the world. Principle that will apply as long as time shall last? Are we to be a peculiar people, distinct from the world? So the principles do apply. We need to learn the lessons of the statutes and apply the lessons, but not the details. And that's the same for feasts. Learn the lessons of the feasts, but not the details. All right, let's go on. Ellen White said, "Well would it be for us to have a Feast of Tabernacles." Boy, that sounds pretty definite, doesn't it? Well would it be for us to have a Feast of Tabernacles. She said, "Shall we not gather our forces together and come up to the Feast of Tabernacles?" So we need to be having a Feast of Tabernacles, right? She follows that up by saying, "Therefore come to the camp meeting, even though you have to make a sacrifice to do so." And the camp meeting she was talking about was in December, wrong time of the year for the Feast of Tabernacles. It referred to camp meeting time. So it was not a commemorative event for the past, but an evangelistic for the present and the future. She said, "Then shall your life henceforth be a continual Feast of Tabernacles, a continual thank offering." We're to have a continual Feast of Tabernacles, which is a thank offering. My manuscript releases 18:270. James White wrote about camp meeting, "These annual Feasts of Tabernacles are gatherings of the greatest importance." So our pioneers understood the feasts to be camp meetings, and we can have the same understanding today. Since it's very clear that Ellen White did not observe the feasts and the annual Sabbath, some explanation has to be found for why God's end-time prophet did not keep these statutes, these feasts, necessary for translation. Here's an explanation. The Holy Spirit did not allow Daniel to fully understand what he wrote. The same happened to Mrs. White with God's festivals. That's their explanation. Well, Daniel is dealing with sealed prophecies that the Lord told him to seal up until the time of the end. Wouldn't be understood for 2,300 years. While Ellen White is explaining those prophecies and writing much about the statutes and ceremonies. I don't think that works very well. For Ellen White, the feasts equal holy convocations equal camp meetings. Nothing more. There is nothing about an appointed time. We must have the Feast of Tabernacles at the right time of the year and the Jewish month. Nothing about that at all. Well, they have another argument. Like Luther was not given the Sabbath, Ellen White was not given all the light on God's feasts. Catch that one? Like Luther was not given the truth on the Sabbath, Ellen White was not given all the light on God's feasts. Well, first of all, that's a clear admission of the lack of evidence for a feast keeping in the writings of Ellen White. All right, so that's clear. But Luther, my goodness, Luther in great darkness, understanding a few principles, did not have light on many subjects. Is Ellen White a prophet of God at the end of time, as ignorant, as uninspired Luther was about an issue necessary for the seal of God? How does that possibly work? So as in other subjects, name of God, Trinity, futurism, the claim is made that Ellen White just didn't understand. We have more light than she. We must go farther than the inspired writings. We must learn God's will, even though the prophet didn't. That's the claim right here. All right, what about Jesus? The claim is made that Jesus kept the annual feast. Here's a statement. Jesus traveled up and down the breadth of the land, giving his invitation to the feast. There it is. Jesus kept the feasts. We must keep the feasts like Jesus. Well, let's try a statement or two. Desire of Ages, page 450. Since the healing at Bethesda, he had not attended the national gatherings. His apparent neglect of the great religious assemblies. He himself seemed to be indifferent to the service which had been divinely established. That doesn't sound like he kept the feasts. They said he wasn't going to the feasts. Desire of Ages 451. For many months he had been absent from the feasts. So he didn't go to the feasts. They say he did. He did not go to the feasts. Now here's the real question. In Deuteronomy, the statute is very clear. Every male in Israel was to attend at least the three major feasts of the Jews. Passover, Day of Atonement, Tabernacles. Every male had to do it. If the feasts are part of the moral law, can you say, well, I just won't keep those feasts. I'll keep the seventh day Sabbath, but I won't keep the feasts. Because Jesus kept the seventh day Sabbath, but he did not observe all the feasts. If you are doing that, are you not breaking the moral law? And as then is Jesus not breaking the moral law when he does not attend the feasts, if they are part of the moral law? Serious question. if these are really part of the moral law. The reality is they're not part of the moral law. All right? Jesus did not keep all the feasts. It is said, Desire of Ages 652 says, during the last Passover supper, the national festival of the Jews was to pass away forever. That's what she says. The national festival of the Jews was to pass away forever. And the feast keepers say that this refers only to the sacrifices on the Passover, not to the seven-day feast of unleavened bread. In other words, we don't sacrifice an animal, but we keep the seven-day feast of unleavened bread. So it's only the sacrifices that ended. I'm going to give you a couple references on this. Acts of the Apostles, 390 and 391. Paul tarried to keep the Passover during the 8 days of the feast. During the 8 days of the feast of Passover, okay? Luke 22, verse 1, the entire feast is called the Passover. The 7 days are called the Passover, although they only had a Passover meal on Friday evening, on the first day. In Ezekiel 45, verse 21, the Passover was the feast of 7 days. The Passover was the entire feast of 7 days. Acts 12, 3 and 4, again, the Passover, the entire feast of 7 days. So the bottom line, in common usage, the word Passover meant Feast of Unleavened Bread, which included one Sabbath and then the next Sabbath, 8 days of feast keeping, and the national festival. So when Ellen White says the national festival of the Jews was to pass away forever, she means the entire 7 day feast of unleavened bread, not just the 1 day of Passover. The reason I'm sharing these with you is these are all the arguments that are presented as to why you have to be a feast keeper or else you will not receive the seal of God. Here is what we read in Signs of the Times, July 29, 1886. After the crucifixion, it was a denial of Christ for the Jews to continue to offer the burnt offerings and sacrifices which were typical of his death. So after the crucifixion, no Christian was to offer a sacrifice. That would have meant Christ hadn't died. No Christian could ever offer a sacrifice after Jesus died. Commenting on the Jerusalem Council, she says, the council had decided that the converts from the Jewish church might observe the ordinances of the Mosaic law if they chose, while those ordinances should not be made obligatory upon the Gentiles. That sketches from the life of Paul, page 121. Now, she said that the council decided that they might observe the ordinances of the Mosaic law if they chose, but the Gentiles didn't have to. Number one, that can't refer to the sacrifices. No one could offer a sacrifice. So what was not allowable for the Jews and the Gentiles, sacrifices, is not under discussion here. Only the other ordinances of the Mosaic law are optional. Circumcision is optional. The feasts are optional. The way they washed their hands, those were all optional ways to observe the Mosaic law during this time. The Jewish converts could continue to do these things if they chose, but they were not necessary. That's what the Jerusalem Council decided. And surely something would have been said if these feasts were necessary after the death of Jesus Christ. Statement from Story of Redemption, page 306. Paul knew that the typical ceremonies must soon altogether cease. Soon altogether cease. Interesting statement that I found in Christ Triumphant. Christ Triumphant, page 281. Many who at that time united in the services of the Passover never again took part in them. Light was to shine into their hearts. This is talking about when the veil of the temple was torn from top to bottom. And she says, many at that time who took part in the service of the Passover never again observed the Passover. So that's pretty interesting, too, in terms of historical perspective. All right, what about Paul? Yep, Paul kept the feasts. You can read about it in Acts 20, verse 6, with converts at Philippi. That was Passover. Pentecost is mentioned also. Why did Paul keep the feasts if we don't have to keep the feasts today? Well, let's read a text. Let's go to the book of Acts. Acts chapter 21. Look at verse 24. Paul had come here. The background of this story here is that Paul is coming up to Jerusalem. He is he's received by the brethren. He speaks to the Jews. And here is what they tell him to do to help win the Jews to Christ. Verse 24. Then take and purify thyself with them, and be at charges with them, that they may shave their heads, and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing, but that thou walkest orderly and keepest the law. What are they advising Paul to do? Keep one of the statutes having to do with purification. And this was the whole, if you read this carefully, each part of this is part of a particular statute of the Old Testament. And they were telling Paul, if you do that, you will set aside their suspicions that you are anti-law. You will gain some favor with the Jews. And Paul did it. Paul kept this particular purification ceremony. Why? To reach the hearts of the Jews. Because they would listen if he did this. That was his reason for doing it. And remember, the council had decided that some of the Jewish things could be done. They didn't rule that out, so Paul was doing it with the Jewish and Gentile converts as a sign of unity. Here's the reason. Between 34 and 70 AD, you have a transition period. What ended in 34? The period of Jewish theocracy, in which the Jews would be used by God to win the world to Christ. That ended in 34 AD. What happened in AD 70? Jerusalem was destroyed, completely destroyed. In between that time, are there a lot of Jews believing they're still the chosen people of God? Are there a lot of Jewish converts to Christianity? So some of these Jewish converts to Christianity are still keeping the statutes in various ways up until Jerusalem is destroyed, and then they can't even offer a sacrifice anymore, and it's all gone. So once 70 occurs, it's all done. They can't even keep one of the statutes, really. Their whole economy is destroyed. But between 34 and 70, you have a period in which some of the feasts were being kept. Some of the ordinances, such as circumcision, were being done. Various things were still being done in this transition period. Does that mean we're to keep them today? No. This was a time of transition between Judaism and Christianity, and things were allowed during that period of time for the sake of winning people's hearts to Christ. All right, what about our pioneers? Listen to J.N. Andrews. When that city was destroyed, the complete cessation of their feasts, and as a consequence of the annual Sabbaths, which were specified days in those feasts, must occur. Complete cessation. The Jewish festivals were utterly extinguished with the final destruction of Jerusalem. That's when they ended, by the way. Not at the death of Christ, but when Jerusalem was destroyed. Joseph Bates, when their feasts ceased to be binding on them, these Sabbaths must also. When the feasts ended, the annual Sabbaths ended. Uriah Smith, the feast days, new moons, and ceremonial Sabbaths were to cease at the cross. James White, new moons, feast days, and Sabbaths of the Jewish law ceased. So our pioneers, not one of them, kept the seventh day, kept the annual feasts. Another interesting little sidelight, and these are just little sidelights right now. The three primary feasts were to be observed at the temple. They could not be observed in captivity because they were tied to the Israelite agricultural calendar, which had a 13th month, which was added every time the calendar got out of whack. They followed a lunar cycle, not our cycle of calendar at all. So you couldn't keep the feasts in captivity because you did not have an agricultural cycle and you did not have Jerusalem to work with. How then can we keep them in the United States of America? And by the way, the first fruits of the harvest are 6 months later on the southern hemisphere than they are in the northern hemisphere. So how do you work that out? It simply doesn't work in our lifetime, in our situation. Now, I'm going to take you to Leviticus 23, which is the primary text in the Old Testament to prove that the annual Sabbaths and the weekly Sabbaths are one and the same thing. Okay? This is the text in the Old Testament. Leviticus chapter 23. All right? In verse 2, notice it says, "Speak unto the children of Israel and say unto them, concerning the feasts of the Lord, which ye shall proclaim to be holy convocations. Feasts, here is moed. Remember that word, moed? The word here is moed. Verse 2, the appointed time. And then what is verse 3 talking about? Seventh day Sabbath. See? So here it is said, since the feasts are the same as the seventh day Sabbath, all of them must be kept. That is their primary proof text. But verse 4, these are the feasts of the Lord. So in verse 3, you have the seventh day Sabbath. In verse 4 and 5, you have the Passover. And then you have the wave sheaf down farther along. You have the harvest. All the way through this chapter, you have all of the feasts, and it is connected with the seventh day Sabbath, except for one little problem. Notice the wording carefully. In verse 3, 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of rest and holy convocation. Ye shall do no work therein. No work therein. All right? We'll go down just a little bit farther right here in terms of what the feasts are all about to verse 8. This is now the feast of Passover. But ye shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord 7 days. In the seventh day is an holy convocation. Ye shall do no servile work therein. That's a different word. Words are important. In verse 3, no work shall be done. In verse 8, no servile work. Look that one up. It means heavy duty work, daily labor, occupations to earn a living. No servile work. You could still work around the house. You could still do light activity, but you could do no work on the seventh day Sabbath. No work on the Sabbath, no servile work on the feast days. One other thing. Go down to verse 37. These are the feasts of the Lord, these annual feasts, which ye shall proclaim to be holy convocations, to offer an offering by fire. All right? Verse 38, beside the Sabbaths of the Lord. In other words, the feasts of the Lord are beside or in addition to the Sabbaths of the Lord, meaning the seventh day Sabbath. So in this category, Sabbaths of the Lord always refers to the seventh day Sabbath. Sabbaths of the Lord is never used of the feast days. Sabbaths of the Lord is used exclusively for the seventh day Sabbath. Feasts of the Lord are the annual Sabbaths. Seventh day Sabbath, Sabbaths of the Lord, feast days, special days for the Lord, for the annual feast to be observed. So there is, and there's another term. My Sabbaths in the Old Testament is always seventh day Sabbaths. Annual Sabbaths are always called your Sabbaths. My Sabbath, seventh day, your Sabbaths, feast days. In very subtle ways, God is making a distinction between the annual Sabbaths and the weekly Sabbath by using different terms to describe them. So even Leviticus 23 does not prove that we must keep the feasts. The claim is made that the sacrifices can be separated from the feast, but the Hebrew word chak is one of the words by which feasts are called. It literally refers to the sacrificial victim. And so whenever the word chak is used, it refers to the sacrifice on the feast. And how can you separate the feast from the sacrifices offered on those feasts? That becomes a very difficult issue, which is being done today. Finally, while the study of the feasts contribute very valuable lessons about the plan of salvation, and our time is well spent in studying them in depth, to make them a test at the same level as the seventh day Sabbath is making a man-made rule to obstruct and overturn the law of God, in the same way that the Sunday tradition destroys the Sabbath. Any man-made rule which takes precedence over God's law and God's will is tradition over Scripture. And I think we're having that same problem right now. Human reason over divine instruction. Life and death issues do not need inferences drawn from words and possible meanings. God always makes them crystal clear. Those are the reasons that I believe that this massive movement that is now being drawn across the United States and around the world is not new light at all, but old error, which is coming to bear again. I'm going to share one last thing with you. It has nothing to do with the feasts, but remember there is something about this. When we begin to go astray on an issue, it is easy to start going astray on other issues as well. In the little book, which is very popular right now among feast keepers, by Melody and Richard Drake, called God's Holidays, I'm going to read you a few sentences. Our old natures are taken away, and our new natures are given to us during the Great Tribulation. Our new nature is given to us when our sins are blotted out during the latter rain. We will then come to the condition of sinlessness in which Adam lived. The only way God's people will not sin is if they have been given a perfect nature. Our very nature and being is still sin. Even when we are not willfully sinning, we are in a state of sin. Our sinful nature has to be changed before probation closes forever. Our sinful natures have to be changed, or we will not be able to stand for one moment after the close of probation without sinning. In other words, well, a couple more. We must reach Adam's pre-fall nature before the second coming. The only way they can be holy is if he has given them their new nature. As long as we have a sinful nature, we are defiled. Therefore, when God's people are sealed, the sinful nature must be removed from them, and then they are no longer tempted with evil. What have I just read to you? Original sin. We are sinners because we inherited a sinful nature, and as long as we have that sinful nature, we will continue to be sinners in need of forgiveness. That's a Catholic doctrine. And if this is going to be removed from us at any time prior to the second coming of Christ, at the seal of God, close of probation, we're talking about holy flesh, my friends. That we will be given a perfect nature, holy flesh. Ellen White says, all may now obtain holy hearts, but it is not correct to claim in this life to have holy flesh. No human being on the earth has holy flesh. This is an impossibility. Selected Messages, Volume 2, page 32. And she has a number of other statements, page 33. Holy flesh was a heresy that came into the Adventist church around the year 1900. And it was strongly opposed by Ellen White and the leaders of the church at that time. And guess what? Because of a very dangerous error called feast keeping necessary for salvation, we are falling back into that old trap, which should have been taken care of 100 years ago. Error is always dangerous. Error always leads to further errors. Error always leads to a problem. And I'm not going to take time to talk about this. We are now getting into something called lunar Sabbaths, which has nothing to do with the days of the week anymore. It has to do with the days of the month. You sight the moon in the sky, the crescent moon. You count 8 days, you keep your Sabbath. You count another 7, you keep the next Sabbath. Next month you start a new sequence. You count 8 more days. Sabbath might be on Tuesday or Wednesday or Friday. And then because there is a problem with the monthly cycle, that the lunar cycle is 29 or 30 days, then you've got to have an extra day at the end of the month, which is a non-day. What do you do with that extra day? All kinds of strange teachings coming out of this feast-keeping issue. Won't even take time to go into that. So, my friends, I would simply say that it's not coincidence that several unrelated issues are coming together among very faithful Seventh-day Adventists. Only the Hebrew name for God can be used. Holy Spirit is not a person. Christ had a beginning at some point in time. Application of prophecies into the future, keeping of the feast days, because faithful Adventists are very frustrated with the delay, and we're trying to come up with a reason, a new light, something that will help us to change. And so I'm going to say this. Satan doesn't care how he traps us. He might trap us in worldliness, he might trap us in a false gospel, or he can trap us in new light, which is not new, but old error. And he can trap conservatives just as much as he can trap liberals with these things. There's only one test that I read of in the Bible at the end of time: loyalty to God's commandments and the faith of Jesus. Here are they that keep his commandments. Righteousness by faith. Now, that's not as glamorous as researching names or Trinity or prophecies or Hebrew ordinances. But being a part of the 144,000 is not primarily about knowledge, it's about surrender. It's about a heart that is willing to let the Holy Spirit work. The 144,000 is more about character than it is about theology, even though theology is very important. So let's keep our focus clear. Let's not be misled by new light, which is not new and is not light. Well, these subjects, my friends, have been a little difficult. They've been technical in some areas, but the reason that Pastor Stearman suggested that we study them is because these are issues which you will have to face somewhere, sometime, maybe among friends and relatives or acquaintances, and you need to know what you believe and why you believe it. Thank you for allowing us to be part of your church on this Sabbath.